The World is supported by LegalZoom for those wanting to start a business or secure their family's future. From wills and trusts to LLCs and trademarks, LegalZoom is committed to helping people get started. LegalZoom.com/world.
Arsonist or firefighter? Today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. President Trump claims that if not for his election, the U.S. would be at war with North Korea. Really?
You know, in this case, he was the arsonist that raised the temperature, threatening fire and fury, and then wanted to be the fireman and put out the fire.
And overall, how does talking to North Korea fit in with, say, not talking to Iran?
It's very hard to create one unified global strategy out of the disparate threads of Trumpism.
But when it comes to ending America's wars, a thumbs up for the president from this veteran's widow.
I think a great nation doesn't fight an endless war, but a great nation never gives up on the cause of freedom.
Those stories and much more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Good to have you here today. Winston Churchill supposedly said, "Jaw-jaw is better than war-war." That is a reference, by the way, to talking. It's a sentiment echoed by Donald Trump in his State of the Union address last night with regards to North Korea.
If I had not been elected president of the United States, we would right now, in my opinion, be in a major war with North Korea.
If true, that would be a significant accomplishment. But often with Donald Trump, there is a reality gap. So what is the truth? We know there is no war right now. We also know there's going to be more jaw-jaw. Trump announced last night he will hold a second summit meeting with North Korea's leader Kim Jong-un at the end of the month. Vietnam will be the venue, and the summit will last 2 days. Vipin Narang is with us to discuss the North Korea-U.S. summit. He's in political science at MIT. So Trump is bragging about averting war with North Korea. Would you say that's true?
Well, like you said, there's often a gap, Marco, between Trump's statements and reality. You know, in this case, Trump was the arsonist that raised the temperature and then wanted to be the fireman and put out the fire. And to be clear, I think, the reason why there was no war on the Korean Peninsula was because Kim Jong-un successfully acquired a nuclear ICBM capability. And once he did that, any attempt to try to disarm him or remove him from power was basically off the table. And so Trump can claim some credit, and I think it's reasonable to give him credit for accepting the olive branch from Kim Jong-un in 2018 when he started his charm offensive. But it was Kim Jong-un that initiated that.
So, Vipin, what you're saying is basically the war crisis of 2017 between the U.S. and North Korea was something of Trump's own making. I mean,
absolutely. When he's making these threats about fire and fury and, telling then Secretary of State Rex Tillerson that diplomacy was a waste of time, as North Korea was testing all of these capabilities and reasonably worried that the U.S. might try to take him or his force out, adding kerosene to the fire wasn't helpful and raised the temperature. And that was Trump's doing.
So contrary to Trump's messaging, as much as North Korea has backed off the testing, they've never promised to denuclearize without
Correct.
The U.S. reciprocating. So Correct. What exactly has been achieved in this mise-en-scène of rapprochement between the U.S. and North Korea?
Well, so I do think, it's plausible, and I think it's actually probable that North Korea doesn't need to test in order to have a plausibly reliable ICBM and nuclear weapons capability against the U.S. homeland. Mm. But there's certain things that they may want to perfect in their systems where testing might help them. So not testing is actually, that it's not nothing. But it's certainly the case that Kim Jong-un and North Korea has not slowed down production of fissile material. They are still maintaining missile bases. They never said they wouldn't. They're still producing nuclear weapons and ICBMs. And it gets to this point about what they committed to. North Korea isn't deceiving anybody. They never committed to giving up their nuclear weapons. Mm. There's no agreement from the Singapore summit in which North Korea concretely agreed to certain steps other than, dismantling test sites. But that isn't dismantling production facilities.
Well, let's nail this down because I feel we're kind of circling around an inevitable conclusion here. Am I right in saying that under Trump, the U.S. has basically given up demanding North Korea give up its nuclear weapons, and now we're just learning to live with a nuclear-armed North Korea?
I think that's your assessment is fair, that Trump has basically decided that he, we can maintain a long-term goal of North Korean disarmament and denuclearization. But in the short term, we have to live with it. And if we can achieve a slowdown in the production of fissile material, caps on nuclear weapons, and certainly long-range ballistic missiles, that's not nothing right now. And very few states have agreed to that. The question is whether there's enough time between now and the summit at the end of the month to hammer out the details, because for the summit to be worthwhile for the United States, we need an agreement that's as concrete as possible to avoid, you know, loopholes that North Korea can walk through. Right now, the loopholes and all the, you know, declarations and agreements are so big, you could drive an ICBM tail through it. So we want an agreement to be extremely concrete. The North Koreans, for the agreement to be worthwhile, want to be as vague as possible.
Vipin Narang at MIT. Thanks very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you, sir.
We often turn to New Yorker staff writer Susan Glasser to get a perspective on how the rest of the world views the U.S. Happy day after State of the Union, Susan.
Well, thank you.
We just heard from Vipin Narang at MIT, and President Trump sounded upbeat when it came to the prospect of negotiations with North Korea. But when Trump described his relations with Iran, the contrast was pretty stark.
My administration has acted decisively to confront the world's leading state sponsor of terror, the radical regime in Iran. It is a radical regime. They do bad, bad things. To ensure this corrupt dictatorship never acquires nuclear weapons, I withdrew the United States from the disastrous Iran nuclear deal.
Susan Glasser, how does that sound to America's allies in the rest of the world, especially in contrast to his warm feelings and kind of coziness with North Korea and Kim Jong-un?
It's a very bifurcated foreign policy, right? It's very hard to create one unified global strategy out of the disparate threads of Trumpism. And I think that's one of the problems, is that we're always trying to project a doctrine onto what is really a series of both individual approaches and then, in the case of President Trump in particular, a series of instincts and reactions. Reflexive anti-Iranianism is at the centerpiece, certainly, of how he and his administration have framed their approach to the Middle East. And it has been a sticking point with allies in Europe, especially given the withdrawal from the Iran nuclear deal.
I mean, I'm talking about our allies and their whiplash, but I mean, a lot of people might have gotten whiplash listening to this part of Trump's speech. One minute, Iran is not to be trusted, but when it came to the Taliban?
The hour has come to at least try for peace, and the other side would like to do the same thing. It's time.
I mean, I'm sure nobody wants the war to continue in Afghanistan, but what are you hearing from outside the U.S. on Afghanistan? Like, how is Trump's interest in cutting a deal with the Taliban playing elsewhere?
One interesting undercurrent of some of Trump's forays in international diplomacy and deal making so far is an emerging sense among some of our adversaries in Russia and China, for example, that Trump has actually been quite naive and played on the world stage when he's attempted to make deals. And, you know, this very credulous sounding statement, almost naivete, when it comes to the Taliban, a pretty thuggish, repressive group, after all, you know, isn't striking to the hard-nosed realpolitik often practiced in the Kremlin by Xi Jinping in Beijing. In fact, just this week, the Kremlin is hosting Afghan politicians, although not the Afghan government, in talks with the Taliban in Moscow. And I think the message is very clear, which is to say, you can't have a peace that's just midwifed anymore by the United States of America. We're no longer the only superpower that matters. And Russia is demanding to be in the middle of those talks as well.
Trump did cover a lot of ground, some zigging and zagging. And somewhere in the middle of all of it, there was this warning for Americans.
Here in the United States, we are alarmed by the new calls to adopt socialism in our country. America was founded on liberty and independence, and not government coercion, domination, and control. We are born free, and we will stay free.
Well, I mean, there have been calls for taxation on the very rich, but how is a comment like that, Susan Glasser, heard elsewhere around the globe? Does it make the planet think we're about to restart the House Un-American Activities Committee?
You know, it's interesting. I just finished writing my column for The New Yorker today, and that was the theme of my piece, was why was President Trump talking about socialism? You know, you and I and probably your listeners didn't think that there was any immediate threat of a socialist takeover of the country, to me, it's very much about 2020 and the beginning of President Trump's reelection campaign. And it does seem to me that he will be running against socialist, left-leaning Democrats and making America out as if, you know, we're just one elected official away from a Venezuelan hellscape here in the United States.
New Yorker staff writer Susan Glasser, always a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
State of the Union, how about State of the Planet? Equally noteworthy in Trump's address last night was what he did not talk about. Top of the list, the climate crisis. The World's Environment editor Peter Thompson is with me now. Peter, what is your take on what the president did not say?
Well, we should start with the fact that it was no big surprise that the president did not say a word about the climate crisis, because he doesn't believe that it is a crisis. And in fact, as we all know, he doesn't even believe that climate change is a real thing, even though it's about as real as gravity. We know the world's warming up fast. We know this is mostly because of pollution from burning fossil fuels. We know that this warming is having a massive impact on our weather and our ecosystems and oceans and on human health and well-being. There are growing warnings from all over, including the Pentagon and Trump's own Director of National Intelligence. But the president dismisses all of this, not a word, last night.
So the crisis is staring us in the face. What are the consequences of the president not talking about it?
To a certain degree, the State of the Union sets the national agenda. It tells us what the president wants to accomplish, what he thinks is important. So what we have is an administration that's ignoring not just the warning signs about the future, but the ways that climate change is actively affecting our lives right now.
And remind us of what some of those effects are.
Well, let's just look at the last year. We had the massive deadly fires in California. These were at least partly due to the fact that the state is warming up and drying out. And these are a growing threat to the largest state in the country and the largest economy in the country. We had Hurricane Michael, which slammed the Southeast and the Carolinas with record flooding. That came on the heels of three huge storms the year before. All of those storms were supercharged by warmer seas. The polar vortex just these last couple of weeks, the disruption of that, that may well be linked to the warming of the Arctic, ironically, causing this massive blast of cold air coming down into the U.S. and killing people.
Yeah, I mean, all of that matters. But how much does it matter what a president does or doesn't say in a State of the Union address? Besides, we're learning now that under Trump, more Americans care about climate change than under Obama.
Well, again, the speech tends to help set the national conversation. And obviously, Donald Trump wants to steer that conversation in certain directions and away from others. But you're right. What matters most is what a president does. And in this case, the president is actually very much putting his lack of concern about the climate crisis into action. It's been a huge part of his agenda over the last 2 years. And he actually did allude to that last night. He talked about his success in getting rid of regulations. What he didn't mention is that a huge number of those regulations are environmental regulations that protect people and ecosystems that support us. He also said this.
The United States is now the number one producer of oil and natural gas anywhere in the world.
So what he's touting there is that the U.S. is now the biggest producer of some of the very fossil fuels that are the biggest contributors to the climate crisis. And then, of course, there's coal that the president has been pulling every lever possible, trying to revive the industry. So these policies, along with his efforts to roll back these existing efforts to fight climate change, are actively moving us backward on the fight against climate change.
Peter, any hope for the next year with a new Congress?
Well, the democratically controlled House is certainly going to turn up the heat on this. They are going to be holding hearings. They've appointed a special committee. They are considering this idea of the new Green Deal, which would pair climate action with job creation. Having said that, there's only so much the House can do. So really, I think what's going to change in the next 2 years is the Democrats and a few Republicans are going to try to steer the conversation. Donald Trump wants to steer it one way. These folks are going to try to steer it someplace else.
Meantime, the seas keep rising. The World's Environment editor, Peter Thompson, thanks very much.
Thanks, Marco.
You're with The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. The Senate, back at business, has approved money for security in Israel. It was part of a bill that packaged all sorts of security for the Mideast. Nothing too controversial in there. There was language that rebukes President Trump's withdrawal of troops from Syria. Also this, an articulated opposition of BDS. That's the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions Activism Against Israel. The World's Matthew Bell is here to explain this for us. So the BDS campaign is not new, Matthew. What is the Senate bill doing here in terms of opposing BDS? What does that even mean?
This is legislation from Marco Rubio. He's a Republican senator from Florida. Essentially, this is giving federal backing for the local and state government laws. There are now laws in 26 states that allow those governments to essentially divest or not to sign contracts with businesses or people that endorse a boycott of Israel.
Gotcha. So we could pass this on to like Texas or North Dakota. If they've got people or companies who are proposing bids for the state, they can look at them and say, no, you're part of the BDS movement. We're not doing business with you.
Exactly. And Senator Rubio says this is needed because, in his view, Israel is a democracy. It's America's most important ally in the Middle East. And he says that the BDS movement is really anti-Israel, that it is against the Jewish state. And Rubio says this is discriminatory economic warfare, and he wants to do something about it.
So Rubio's a Republican, and I gather that the Republicans in the Senate largely supported this bill. What about the Democrats?
The Democrats are divided. Call me cynical, but this is probably one reason why the Republicans have pushed this issue. Democratic lawmakers, many of them have been also big supporters of Israel over the years. And then some say, well, look, we don't support BDS. We do support Israel. But what we don't want is to make laws that actually threaten the First Amendment. They say this is really a free speech issue.
So the bill goes to the House now. What are its chances of passing there? And where else is this issue going to play out?
Right. Goes to the House. It's very unlikely to go anywhere in the House, partly because of that reason. The Democrats are so divided. They don't want to get into this. But those laws are starting to be challenged in the courts. This controversy is definitely not going away. That is something I talked about with Maha Nassar today. She's at the School of Middle Eastern and North African Studies at the University of Arizona.
I think that the larger media attention that's being given to it is useful in that a lot of people who hadn't really heard about BDS or didn't really know what it was now are coming to hear about it and are coming to hear about it in the context of attempting to suppress people's First Amendment rights. And that's their sort of immediate introduction to it.
So this was a vote by the U.S. Senate, but BDS is a seriously global movement. What will this language from Washington do for the rest of the movement?
If you go to the Middle East, talk to, say, Palestinians in a place like Lebanon, this is a big issue. There's a lot of support for it. Also in Europe is a place where boycotting Israel is really more of a mainstream idea. It plays out differently in American politics. And again, it's not going away here.
The World's Matthew Bell, always a pleasure. Thanks.
Thanks, Marco.
Israelis hold national elections in April, and if he's reelected, Benjamin Netanyahu could become the country's longest sitting prime minister. Netanyahu is facing corruption allegations, but he's still leading in the polls. Bibi is also known as Mr. Security, but someone else is now vying for that title, a political outsider and a former leader of the Israel Defense Forces. Rebecca Collard reports from Tel Aviv.
Former Army Chief Benny Gantz enters his rally in Tel Aviv to cheers from the crowd. Gantz is seen as Benjamin Netanyahu's toughest competition for prime minister in the April elections. Gantz's slogan, Israel First. The chorus of his theme song is, there's no more right or left, just Israel before all else.
המאבק בין שמאל לימין קורע אותנו. ההתנגשות בין דתיים לחילוניים מפצלת אותנו.
The struggle between left and right rips us apart, he tells the crowd. Quarrels between religious and secular divide us. Gantz's new party is called Israel Resilience, and the day after his inaugural campaign event, it nearly doubled in the polls. The increase would put his party second only to Benjamin Netanyahu's right-wing Likud party. Unseating Netanyahu would be extremely difficult, but it's possible by the time of the April election, Netanyahu could be indicted. He's accused of doing favors for one of Israel's biggest telecom companies in return for favorable media coverage. Netanyahu has pledged not to resign, even if indicted. Gantz rallied against corruption this week in a clear jab at Netanyahu. The notion that in Israel, a prime minister can remain in office while under indictment is ridiculous, he tells the crowd. Gantz is taking pains to present himself as a centrist, someone who is not on the left, an increasingly unpopular position in Israel. Journalist Gad Harel says decades of a failed peace process have pushed Israelis to the right.
People are, they don't like it. They say left is no good. He's trying to fit no right, no left, because he's going to focus on the center.
Gantz wants to make it clear that he can be Mr. Security. And even before the rally, he released a series of videos themed Only the Strong Survive. This one shows neighborhoods in the Gaza Strip that were destroyed in the 2014 Israeli offensive, which Gantz led as head of Israel's army. The UN says more than 2,000 Palestinian civilians were killed in that offensive. The video boasts that parts of Gaza were returned to the Stone Ages and that the offensive resulted in 3.5 years of quiet. But Gantz's military record comes with baggage here. Outside the rally, a group protests. They blame Gantz for not retrieving the bodies of two Israeli soldiers held by Hamas in Gaza.
This is why we're here, because Gantz was the chief at this time.
Yifat and Mimi's cousin is one of the missing soldiers.
For Israel to be strong, you have to take care of their soldiers.
Back inside, Gantz's supporters say he's honest. Another dig at Netanyahu's looming corruption charges. And despite his hawkish videos, he's pledging to talk peace. In another video, he says there's no shame in making peace and asks Israelis, in 25 years, do we still want to be sending our children to fight? It's a departure from the rhetoric of Netanyahu and many other Israeli leaders. At the rally, Albert Sheltel says he doesn't see a big difference between Gantz and Netanyahu.
He's not much different than Halikud. He has the same way of living and political opinion as Benjamin Netanyahu. Very much similar.
Despite the corruption allegations, Sheltel thinks Netanyahu should continue as prime minister. Sheltel says Gantz is missing something important, civilian political experience.
Yeah, I do admire the gentleman as the best leader of IDF, one of the best ever. But still, Israeli politics is too complicated and it's too early for him to see himself in the shoes of prime minister of Israel.
Generals are good to salute, he says, but not good to vote for. For The World, Rebecca Collard, Tel Aviv.
I'm Marco Werman. Jenny Taylor's husband, Brent, was killed while serving in Afghanistan, but she knows he left a positive mark there.
I can't tell you how many soldiers with whom he served from around the world have sent me private Facebook messages saying, I'm one of your husband's best friends. What a gift is that?
That story, still ahead, here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Crime at the U.S. border with Mexico was a big talking point in President Trump's State of the Union last night. He focused on El Paso, Texas, and said the border city had high rates of crime before a wall was built.
Immediately upon its building, with a powerful barrier in place, El Paso is one of the safest cities in our country. Simply put, walls work and walls save lives.
But it is not so simple, and El Paso residents find themselves having to constantly refute the claim. Monica Ortiz Uribe is a journalist in El Paso and a native of the city. She's lived the story as well as reported on it.
It depends where in El Paso where you visit. There is a neighborhood that butts up right along the U.S.-Mexico border in El Paso. That neighborhood is called Chihuahuita. It's one of the oldest in the city. And people there say that the border wall has helped make their neighborhood safer. Before the wall was constructed, people could easily run across the dry bed of the Rio Grande into the neighborhood and cross back into Mexico. The residents who live there said that there was a problem with burglars. burglary, sometimes assaults. Their laundry would get stolen off the line, or a bike would go missing. And there were gangs in Mexico that sometimes crossed over, and this is documented by police. So the wall has proven to be effective in highly urban concentrated areas. But where it loses effectiveness is in more rural and less populated areas.
Before the wall, Monica, what was the reality about crime in El Paso, like in the urban part of El Paso?
Well, I mean, studies have shown that immigrant communities tend to be safer. Immigrants are less likely to commit crimes than U.S. citizens. And El Paso is a city of immigrants going back from its very beginnings. Often people confuse El Paso with its neighboring city in Mexico, Ciudad Juarez. Right. And that city has been among the more violent in Mexico. About a decade ago, when there was a brutal drug war going on in Ciudad Juarez, the Texas governor, Rick Perry, then said that a car bomb had gone off in El Paso when it had actually gone off in Ciudad Juarez. So even our own governor has confused the safety record of El Paso with its sister city in Mexico.
Monica, as I said, you're also a resident of El Paso. What's your life like there? I mean, as far as a border town goes, do you go out at night with no worries these days? Have you ever been scared in El Paso? And if you have, why?
I have lived in El Paso all my life. My grandparents immigrated here from Mexico back in the 40s, and my family has remained in the same neighborhood ever since they came over. And I often go out at night, so does my family. We don't really worry very much about our safety.
In El Paso, what's this moment kind of been like with the president saying these things that a lot of people in El Paso just feel are not true?
It's just this was a false claim that he had made in the past. Many residents here have spoken out to debunk that claim because they know that El Paso has been ranked as one of the safest cities for years and years now, even prior to the construction of the border fence. And it's a claim that's easily debunked by simply looking at FBI statistics in the city and looking at these studies that show, yes, immigrant communities are far safer. Last weekend, residents in El Paso got together and held a protest from downtown El Paso right up to the U.S.-Mexico border, and they all came out in solidarity against Trump's immigration policies and against further construction of a border fence.
Monica Ortiz Uribe is a journalist and also a resident of El Paso, which is where she joined us from. Thanks very much, Monica. Good to speak with you.
You're welcome.
San Antonio, Texas is more than 100 miles from the border, but you find two large immigrant detention centers near there, both of them designed for families. When those detained migrants are released, they're taken to the big city, dropped off in San Antonio. So that's where two California psychotherapists spend their vacation time. Julie Small of KQED in San Francisco explains why.
Alicia Cruz and Chris Mullen have worked together for a decade and see clients in offices right next to each other back in San Francisco. Here in San Antonio, they're getting ready to offer counseling to families in the most unlikely place, the Greyhound bus station.
Let's go.
It's a chilly morning as they drive from their Airbnb to the station. It's Chris's first time here. Alicia's volunteered twice before.
It's not a choice for me. I've got to go. I've got to go help. It was an immense pull that I couldn't really explain.
And Alicia tells Chris the parents may need help talking about what they've been through, in part because they'll need to tell their stories to U.S. asylum officers.
You could see sometimes how intense and overwhelmed they are when they're reliving their trauma. And you're reliving it sort of with them in a way.
Sure,
it's still very
sure.
raw and fresh because, you know, that's what they're escaping.
When you're really disconnected, and that's often the case with PTSD, right, is that disconnect, then it sounds insincere and also it can be very vague.
When Alicia and Chris arrive at the Greyhound station, dozens of families have already been escorted inside by guards working for ICE. They're buying one-way tickets to reach family members or sponsors around the country. The parents and children are easy to spot in their brightly colored sweatsuits, parkas, and brandless tennis shoes issued by ICE. Many are sick and coughing, and they look dazed in these first moments of freedom.
Hay una noche.
Nuns from a local church hand out box lunches and backpacks with toiletries. Then Alicia and Chris work their way down the benches, providing legal information to families and asking about their experiences crossing the border.
Buenos días.
Buenos días.
Pues gracias por compartir. Sé que es difícil.
The therapists are also keeping an eye out for signs of trauma or shock. They say people who fled violence are often re-triggered on the dangerous journey here and their time in U.S. detention.
Tengo un juguete.
Alicia hands out Ziploc baggies of Legos for the children so they can play while their parents get to talk. Most of the migrants do not want their names used because they fear for the safety of their families. A mother of two tells Alicia she left Guatemala because a gang tried to extort money and threatened to kill her family when she didn't pay up. She describes crossing the Rio Grande with her 10-year-old daughter and 4-year-old son. She starts to cry, remembering her fear that they might die.
Cuando cruzamos el río, nos perdimos.
We didn't have any water to drink. We spent 4-5 hours lost before we got picked up by immigration.
The mother tells Alicia that Border Patrol agents locked the family in a cold, windowless room for 4 days and only gave them one sandwich and one juice box a day. When her children cried, she says, agents told her to shut them up. This isn't your country, they said. After the family was finally transferred to ICE, they were given enough food to eat and access to showers. But the mother tells Alicia she regrets putting her children through this.
I thought it would be easy. People told me, just turn yourself into immigration. But no, it's very difficult.
Alicia listens attentively and reflects back what she's hearing, that the mother made the only choice she could.
The truth is, you didn't come because you wanted to. You came because you had to.
The mom nods and wipes away her tears. A couple hours later, the woman and her kids board a bus to San Francisco, where they have a family member willing to sponsor them. The trip will take 39 hours. Alicia has given her some cash for meals and the name of a place where she can get help when she arrives.
We have a trauma recovery center in San Francisco that works with asylum seekers and does therapy.
While Alicia moves on to speak with another family, the other therapist, Chris, sits down across from a man with a 9-year-old son and asks him why they left Guatemala.
Porque usted decidió salir su país.
The 29-year-old father tells her drug traffickers had built landing strips in the jungle near his town, and he saw local police working with them. One day, a friend told him his name was on a government hit list. The next day, that friend disappeared. As he speaks, tears drop steadily on the sleeve of his jacket.
Yo le, sinceramente, nunca he...
Honestly, I had never thought of leaving, because everything I have is there.
The man crossed the border fence into California last month by climbing a tree with his son clinging to his back.
Yo a mi hijo le dije que se agarrara de acá de mi cuello.
I told my son to grab my neck and hold on really tight. Because I was going to jump, I told him, you have to hold on so you don't fall.
After a week in Border Patrol custody, they were transferred to an ICE facility for fathers and sons. Now they're heading to the East Coast to stay with relatives. Chris is going back to her church in San Mateo to talk about the family she met and how she spent the donations the congregation raised. Alicia plans to return to San Antonio as often as she can. Her family and other parents at her son's school have already donated enough money and frequent flyer miles for her next trip. For The World, Julie Small.
That story was reported in collaboration with KQED Public Radio. Follow more of our reporting about the southern border at theworld.org. While President Trump continues to push for a physical barrier on the southern border, his administration is rolling out a new policy to block asylum seekers. It's called the Migrant Protection Protocols, but it's known as Remain in Mexico. And it means that some migrants who apply for asylum at the border are made to wait in Mexico until their cases are decided, which could be months or more. The policy started last week at the San Diego-Tijuana border crossing, with just a couple dozen migrants returned to Mexico so far. Reporter Sarah Kanosian has been speaking with some of them and described their reactions to being sent back.
It's sort of a mix of confusion with a little bit of disappointment and anger. And because this was the first batch, it really took people by surprise.
Right. So, as you say, a lot of confusion. For example, one of the people you spoke with was a guy named Alonzo. What's his story?
Yeah, so Alonzo fled Honduras. He was fleeing death threats from the MS-13, and he came with his roommate, Ariel. And they, last Tuesday, lined up to present themselves to apply for asylum in the United States. On Wednesday, they were sent back. And there is a bit of confusion because people are given a court date 45 days in the future. So at first, he thinks, you know, I'm going to, after this court date, just go to the United States. So maybe it's fine because I'm only here for another month. But then sort of as the reality is setting in, because he told me that a Mexican official told him it could be a year, he became pretty angry. How am I going to be here a year is what he asked me. They're playing with my life. And so I think that's representative of a lot of people.
Sarah, briefly walk us through what happened to Alonzo and others in his situation once they got to the border.
So once they get to the border, turn themselves into the United States to apply for asylum, a lot of people have told me that they're asking the group that has been let in, who is part of the caravan and who is not part of the caravan, and initially splitting them up that way. They'll then be taken to these holding cells. And then, for instance, in Alonzo's case, he was woken up at 3 in the morning for an interview with an officer who then told him he would be sent back to Tijuana to wait for his court date. And then they were let out with a packet of information.
And told to return to Mexico.
Exactly. Then they were just released back into Tijuana where there was a swarm of reporters.
So in addition to getting that information packet, some of the people you spoke with said they'd been told by border agents to get legal help from a group in Mexico. Tell us about that.
Yeah, this was another sort of curious thing is that several people told me that the agents who they spoke with told them to go to the offices of El Otro Lado and talk to the American lawyers there.
Al Otro Lado, that's a legal organization, an NGO, correct?
Exactly. They provide legal orientation. El Otro Lado, though, is not on this list of legal service providers that the United States is giving to people. In that packet of information that people receive, there are a list of lawyers, but they're all in the United States.
There's one odd detail here. An alert has actually been placed on the U.S. passports of some of these people working with Al Otro Lado. So two of the directors apparently were recently blocked from entering Mexico. What's that about? Do you know who flagged those passports and why it happened?
Yeah. So when two of the directors were trying to enter into Mexico, they were told by the Mexican government that a foreign government had put an alert on their passports, and then they sent them back to the United States. When I spoke with the State Department, they said that no part of the U.S. government had placed an alert on their passports, and the Mexican government did not get back to me with comment. So it's sort of unclear what's happening, but they definitely feel like these are intimidation tactics for their work on the side of the border, working with migrants.
Journalist Sarah Kanosian speaking with us from Tijuana. Check out her in-depth piece on the Remain in Mexico policy at theworld.org. Good to have you with us today, Sarah. Thank you.
Thank you.
One final mention of the State of the Union. Near the end of President Trump's speech last night, he talked about war.
As a candidate for president, I loudly pledged a new approach. Great nations do not fight endless wars.
I can agree with that. I think a great nation doesn't fight an endless war, but a great nation never gives up on the cause of freedom.
That's Jenny Taylor. She was in the gallery of the House chamber as the president delivered his remarks. Her representative, Utah's Rob Bishop, invited Jenny as a way to honor her husband, Brent Taylor. Brent was killed a few months ago in Afghanistan while serving in the Army National Guard. Jenny spoke with me this morning when she was back on Capitol Hill.
When Brent deployed this last fourth time to Afghanistan, it was part of a surge prompted by President Trump saying, let's give this one really good surge. Let's give this a huge push. Let's really try to see if we can make a difference and wrap things up over there. And my husband was well aware of that. He knew he was part of that surge. Not that you would call it a last hurrah, but hey, if we're going to be there, let's really be there. Let's get the troops over there we need, the forces we need, and see if that works, if that makes a difference. And I know the time when Brent was there, he felt they were making a difference. He said they had success every day. They were tracking down and able to get with the Taliban every night. He said, we're just having success. We're doing great things here. If the boots on the ground, if the generals at the Pentagon, if those advisors who know what they're doing and what they're talking about will say, hey, it's time for us to draw down and come home, I will fully support that. And if those same men and women who know what they're doing and are in those top positions say, you know what, we need more troops longer, I would absolutely support that. And so would my husband. Brent would go whenever and wherever he were called, if that's what his nation needed him to do.
So everything I've read about your husband, Brent, suggests that he really loved Afghanistan and the people there. He'd do these regular updates on his Facebook page. What did he want Americans to know about Afghanistan?
I think he wanted them to know that there are good people, that the ones that he worked with were hungry for freedom. They were hungry for justice. They were hungry for a better way of life. He served in Afghanistan first in 2011 and 2012. When he went back in 2018, he inquired about some of the top advisors with whom he had served several years before. Every one of the top advisors he had previously served with had been killed in this fight. Every single one of them. Wow. And that hit home to him. You know, as soon as he got there, he would find out so-and-so had lost his life, so-and-so had been killed, so-and-so had made that ultimate sacrifice. So we're making a sacrifice there, but so are they. Yes, he knew of those who were corrupt and the different things that you are fighting against, but the ones that he really got close to, whether it was the Afghan people or the Spanish troops he worked with or the other NATO forces he worked with, all really shared that spirit of freedom and liberty, that spirit of service to your fellow man that, again, doesn't belong exclusively to America. He had wonderful things to say about the men and women with whom he served. And I think the reason he did is because he took the time to build relationships. He was not the kind of officer that just showed up, sat at a desk, and checked things off the list of here's what I have to do today. He went over and above, out of his way, building relationships, building rapport, eating with the Afghans at lunches, going on hikes and things with them, more than what he had to do or what he was required to do, because he knew that relationships were the key to true leadership, to true service, and any hope for any success. I can't tell you how many soldiers with whom he served from around the world have sent me private Facebook messages saying, I'm one of your husband's best friends. Your husband was my best friend. He was my best friend. Several. I thought, what a gift is that, as an American officer who'd only been there 10 months, to have several people say, oh, Major Taylor was my best friend. They just felt that from him, that genuine love. He wasn't there for glory. He wasn't there for fame. He wasn't there for money. He was there because he loves God and he loves freedom, and he wants to share that with people around the world.
You and your husband had 7 kids. Brent became mayor of North Ogden, Utah, then got deployed back to Afghanistan. I'm thinking that could not have been easy to manage. What do you want members of Congress and the president to know about what it's like being the spouse of a service member?
You know, that's one thing. I actually ran into a House of Representatives gentleman from Florida last night. I can't remember his name right now, but he himself is a combat vet. He's a double amputee and serving in Congress. And I said, I love that there. I hope we see a rise of more military personnel in our upper levels of government leadership. In the greatest generation, in previous generations, you would have, you know, the president's been in the military, members of Congress in the military. Fortunately, my generation hasn't been at war the same way Vietnam was, the same way World War II was, the same way World War I or the Civil War. I say fortunately, meaning the numbers are much smaller in terms of those we've lost. Yes, we've lost too many in Afghanistan, but the number pales in comparison to those previous wars. So I would want Congress to know first and foremost that there is a pride that comes in being a military family. Yes, it's hard. Yes, it requires sacrifice, but sacrifice is always worth it when you're fighting for a cause that's greater than yourself. And even though my husband has now paid this ultimate sacrifice, I can tell you we have no regret for the decisions that we've made. He served proudly. He served with honor. And now it has quite honestly become the greatest honor of my life to be able to say that our family has paid a small price, a small portion, a small contribution in this overall cost of freedom that is excruciatingly high.
Yeah, a lot of people appreciate that selfless approach, but speaking of the greatest generation, I mean, I noticed that last night one of the few things Democrats and Republicans agreed on and applauded to was the recognition of those three heroic men who had landed on the beaches of Normandy coming up on 75 years ago. So one war gets a major embrace, the one the U.S. is currently slogging away at in Afghanistan, barely a mention. What was it like for you to know that one war is honorable and this one doesn't get spoken about that much?
Well, I think a lot of people have forgotten we're still there, to be honest. You know, look at my husband's death and the way it's hit my hometown. Part of the reason it's hit so hard is because he is the first personal connection to a killed in action veteran that most people in our town know. You go back to the greatest generation, everyone knew several someone's killed in action. It happened on a regular occurrence. So largely, you know, you had the beginning of these Iraq and Afghanistan wars. Lots of people were deployed. Lots of men and women were there. We still had that surge of I love America that followed the horrific attacks of 9/11. But 17, 18 years later, I think America gets exhausted of that. And because it doesn't personally affect them, they don't have a husband or a brother or a sister or a friend on the battlefields, I think it's unfortunately easy to forget that we are still there. And we're not just in Afghanistan. We have troops around the world still. So, you know, I think that's part of just an awareness as American citizens. Hey, we have men and women in uniform defending us, defending freedom across the globe. We need to remember that.
Jenny Taylor back in the halls of Capitol Hill, where she was last night at the State of the Union address in honor of her husband, Brent Taylor, the former mayor of North Ogden, Utah, who was killed last year while serving in Afghanistan. Jenny, thanks very much for speaking with us and our belated condolences to you.
Thank you so much. Thank you for your time. Appreciate it.
From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We'll be back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.